Well, thank you very much indeed. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. For that introduction, Michael. Thank you very much. And I'm quite overwhelmed by how many people are here. It's not meant to be like this. but it's very nice to see you all. I'm very, very glad indeed to see you all. I want to think, first of all, about models of medical healthcare. And when we talk about biomedicine, what do we mean by biomedicine? Well, biomedicine is really the idea of how medicine became scientific and very much linked to the Enlightenment project. There are several characteristics of it. It's very much the idea that health is the absence. It's the polar opposite to illness. That identifiable diseases have specific biological causes. That disease is combated by finding specific counter-remedies. And that the role of the patient in a kind of functionalist model is very much to see the doctor as the expert and to cooperate, a sort of passive sick role, which you probably are familiar with that idea. And in this model, prevention is very much an individual responsibility to avoid risk factors. So it's very much a model that's designed for acute disease and illness. And latterly, there's been an enormous concern about the limits of biomedicine as regards chronic illness and long-standing disorders and conditions where there may not be a cure and there may not be a spontaneous resolution. And that critique has built quite considerably, not just from within social science, but increasingly from within medicine itself. So the triumph of biomedicine is obvious and powerful, incredibly powerful. Throughout the 20th century, and I've got this is, sociologists always do things in quotes because they can't, you know, they're always worried about the truth of something. When we talk about Western or developed societies, what I'm meaning is kind of North America, Europe, but it's not even West anymore because it also means Australia, New Zealand, those kinds of developed societies, maybe developed is a better word. And what we've seen across those typical kind of societies are enormous changes in life expectancy. And maybe some complacency about the freedom from infectious disease. But within the UK, for instance, there's a problem because, as it says here, a great deal of the population have long-standing disorders and conditions. Now, that increase in life expectancy can largely be explained by the freedom from infectious disease. Of course, there are other factors. There are the improvements in public health and the decline in poverty and the advances in medical knowledge. But when we look at changing patterns of health and illness across the 20th century and into the 21st, what we see is really a change from the main cause of death being infectious disease to quite different patterning. First of all, the main killers in our societies today, things like cancer, coronary heart disease and stroke, are multi-causal degenerative diseases. It's very difficult to pinpoint an actual cause of a disease. We can't even say, for instance, that smoking causes lung cancer. Of course, we know that smoking increases your chances of getting lung cancer very dramatically. But there's always, you know, everybody's got their uncle, their auntie Ethel, who's smoked 20 cigarettes for 100 years and drank three bottles of whiskey and survived. So there's always an exception to the rule. So we can't pinpoint that cause. So there's those kinds of degenerative illnesses. Then we have, really, I suppose, the price we may pay for that longevity, the diseases that are associated with older age. And then we have a plethora of new diseases, modern diseases, modern illnesses. Often, I'm sure you'll recognise some of these. Does everybody know what a TLA is? Sociologists talk in quotes, whereas medics talk in TLAs. My colleagues emailed me and said, "I'm sorry, I promised not to send you any more TLAs." And I said, emailed him back and said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Triple letter acronyms," which is what all these conditions are. And I'm sure that many of these will be familiar to you. I'm not going to go into what they all are.
Thank you.
So in terms of challenges to biomedicine, there's been quite a lot, particularly in the latter half of the 20th century. We've got the rise of the new public health. I talked earlier about the explanations for the increase in life expectancy also being due to increased public health. The focus on health inequalities, the political economy of health, and how health resources are so unequal in their distribution. A decline in public trust, maybe, in medicine, particularly the kind of the scandals of the late 20th century in this country around people like Harold Shipman, around the Alderhay scandals, have maybe undermined public trust in medicine. Medical uncertainty, a term that's often used to mean the lack of certainty about diagnosis and treatment. A focus very much on doctor-patient relationships and the communication, or sometimes lack of it. The increasing popularity of complementary and alternative medicine, people seeking systems of medicine that actually explain the mind-body relationship, which they don't always feel biomedicine does. And a whole plethora of critiques around medicalization and healthism, which again have maybe come from within social science, but as I said, are very much being adopted and used within medicine as well to address certain problems. And of course, the rise of the lay knowledge and user movements, the rise of things like the expert patient, the use and the increase in information society, and the increase of use of e-health. I haven't got time to explain all those ideas, and I'm sure many of you will be very, very familiar with them, but just to focus for a moment on medicalization. And this is the idea of how this has occurred over the 20th century, and this is the explanation of how medicine has very much attached itself to areas of life that weren't previously under its jurisdiction. I would imagine most of you in this room were born in hospital, and most people think it's something like 88% actually die in some kind of medical setting. So for critics such as Ivan Illich, writing in the 1970s, the process of medicalization brought negative as well as positive aspects by destroying traditional resources, by creating dependence and passivity in patients. And people like Zola and Conrad have talked about the ideological nature of medicine, where medicine can actually be an institution of social control and actually be used to normalize problematic behavior or experience. And the classic example is always given with psychiatry and the uses and abuses that psychiatry has been charged with. And what you get in this process is a kind of polarization between the lay and the professional, what Michler calls the life world versus biomedicine. So that's been a very strong and powerful critique. But by the 21st century, maybe things are not quite so simple. What's often called the project of the body, the idea of the body needing to be something to be worked on, a focus away from medicine to health and lifestyle, dominates every aspect of life across all our aspects of life in terms of identity, in terms of emotion, behavior, and appearance. And what we see is actually an increasing demand for medicalization from the lay public, and particularly around these newer types of diseases. So this boy in this picture, is he just a naughty boy? Is he just somebody who traditionally would have been excluded from school? Or has he got ADHD and needs medicalization, needs treatment? This is incredibly complex. For the teachers, it might be a lot easier to have a medical label. For the parents, it's probably certainly an awful lot easier to have a medical diagnosis than to admit that their child is a problem. For the child itself, certainly some there's been very little research that actually looks at children's own understandings of what's happened to them when they've been diagnosed with ADHD. And some children talk about playing along with a diagnosis in order to please the adults, while others say that actually taking Ritalin has helped them incredibly, helps them to concentrate. So the whole process of medicalization becomes incredibly complex in terms of whose interests it serves. The demand for mood-altering drugs, again, has given rise to the whole movement of pharmascepticism or big pharma. David Healy talks about the age of depression, where despite our improved socioeconomic conditions, there's a need for a quick fix for sort of happiness pills, a kind of Aldous Huxley vision of a brave new world with Soma. And from the 1990s onwards, the antidepressant group of drugs known as the SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, with brand names like Prozac and Zoloft and Paxil, have become household names. By 2006, there were 31 million prescriptions for SSRIs in England. And despite the NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence guidelines, that the first-line treatment for mild depression should not be antidepressants, they continue to rise. Now, these drugs have all sorts of side effects. They were certainly marketed as side effect-free, but they certainly have an impact on all sorts of systems in the body, and much worse, they have very serious withdrawal symptoms. So there is what Healy calls a spectre of dependence here in terms of the proliferation of prescriptions of these kinds of drugs. And there were also a whole series of legal actions following suicides and homicides of people who've been prescribed SSRIs. So what I'm trying to get at here is this idea of healthism. Whereas the move from medicine to health in many ways is an enlightened one, and allows us to think about our mind and body in a connected way. There's also the worry that health has become such an obsession that it literally takes over every single aspect of life, and that some of the solutions that are sought for it are not the best ones. And this is a poll that the BMJ carried out of their GPs in terms of some of the unhappiness they had about things they were being consulted about in terms of non-diseases. So from 1 to 20, these are the things GPs feel that they shouldn't have to deal with but are frequently consulted about. Okay, so back to the mind and body. And a kind of key paper by Nick Dewson called The Disappearance of the Sick Man in Medical Cosmogonies traces how what he calls the loss of the whole person as medicine moved from the bedside to the hospital to the laboratory. The whole person becomes literally missing. And since the 1980s, there's been a kind of explosion of interest in the body, a theoretical interest. For Foucault, the body is a site of contestation and power and biopolitics. For people like Mary Douglas, it's a metaphorical form. For Pierre Bourdieu, it's a form of capital and distinction. Elizabeth Gross shows us how uses a Mabaya strip to show us how the inside of the body becomes the outside. And phenomenology, in particular, has tried to show us the kind of lived experience of the body. Drew Leader talks about how the body, he says the body is the most abiding and inescapable presence in our lives. It's characterized but it's also characterized by its absence. One's own body is rarely the thematic object of experience. The body as a ground of experience tends to recede from direct experience. So he talks about literally the DYS, the disappearing body, the body that's not there. We don't notice it until it actually goes wrong. It becomes ill. And one of the biggest sort of critiques of biomedicine, of course, has been the division into mental and physical illness, the idea of Cartesian dualism, the idea of the mind-body divide, and the crude appropriation of Descartes' challenge to Christian orthodoxy of body and soul by dividing mind and body, and really seeing the body very much as a mechanistic or engineering way, as a kind of series of spare parts that certain specialists can repair or replace. And that division between general medicine and psychiatry has contributed to that neglect of the whole person considerably. And many people feel, especially when we look at patterns of comorbidity, the idea that, for instance, that if you look at something like chronic back pain, it's so very strongly associated with depression, but there's rarely research that kind of links the two of them. So that mind-body divide is really quite incompatible with contemporary understandings of illness and disease. And I just want to read you very quickly an account by Anne Oakley in her book entitled Fracture, where she describes the disjunction between science and subjectivity, the effects of which linger 5 years after her accident, where she experienced a severe compound fracture. She says, "There is, and this remains, this paradox. I don't feel normal, although I am apparently cured. Classical neurology is based on the concept of function, not on that of subjective perception. Restoration of function is what counts, and it's perfectly compatible with the continuing impairment of sensation and of the brain's ability to recognize the repair that's occurred in the damaged limb. This approach fits the body as machine model of Western medicine and the unimportance of what Virginia Woolf called the creature within. It helps to explain why there's been much more research into motor function than into sensibility, despite the fact that, without sensation, the hand is virtually useless. And perhaps the missing link here has something to do with the person." So, when we're thinking about emotional bodies, mind and bodies, and health and illness, in terms of illness first, we need to make these links. Even in severe mental illness, there are extremely somatic components of depression and schizophrenia. The importance of physical functioning is absolutely paramount. The ability to sleep, the ability to eat, even the ability to move. The phenomena of medically unexplained symptoms, again, I'm going to talk a bit more about this later in this presentation, is absolutely crucial in our understanding of this link between mind and body. Comorbidity, as I've said, a very important aspect. And then if we move to health, we can see a whole range of ways of understanding the link across mind and body in terms of body work. Body work meaning fitness, weight, maintenance and beauty, a whole range of, specialisms and ways of managing the body that didn't until recently come under the medical lens. The inclusion of complementary medicine and alternative therapies integrated into conventional medicine, again another way of combining many mind and body across this spectrum. Health promotion and prevention, sexual health and emotional health. So that changing relevance of mental and physical labels becomes increasingly important. And in order to really understand that, we need to think about models of emotion. And emotion traditionally has been, this diagram is quite complex and shows the kind of spectrum of social thought around how we understand emotions. So down at this end, you've got the dominant way of understanding emotion is really a kind of the wired-in instinct of survival that's very much biological, in which the social is very secondary, and where emotions are universal across all cultures. At the other end of the spectrum, a social constructionist idea of emotion, where emotions tend to be culturally and contextually relative. But in the middle, what you've got is this interactionist perspective, where emotions are very much seen as having biological substrates, but which take place and which are managed in social settings. And of course, the importance of the social nature of emotion has been thematic in many, many disciplines. In sociology, it's maybe not been so explicit. It's been implicit in the work of Marx and Durkheim, for instance, in terms of thinking about alienation and enemy. But feminist philosophers have certainly pointed out how, in social thought, again, there is a kind of divorcing of body from mind, of nature from culture, of public from private, and reason from emotion. And emotions in Western thought have tended to be associated with very much with private, irrational, inner sensations associated with forces of nature and women's hysterical bodies. They're often seen as intrinsically gendered. Not for nothing do we get the word hysteria, which, of course, as I'm sure you all know, comes from the Greek meaning wandering womb. So from Plato onwards, the dominant view is that emotions are something that sweep you away, that need to be tamed, need to be harnessed, or driven out through the steady hand of usually male reason. Emotions seem to be the antithesis of detached scientific mind and the quest for objectivity and truth. But historically, of course, we need to learn the lesson for what Reif calls the irrational passion for dispassionate rationality, an ideology devoid of feeling, empathy, and compassion for the plight of one's fellow human beings. And this is an incredibly influential body of work in terms of the interactionist model, which was a social theory put forward by Arlie Hochschild in her book, which has got the most wonderful title, The Managed Heart, The Commercialization of Human Feeling. And what Hochschild does in her social theory of emotion is explain how emotions have biological substrates, but are socially shaped and therefore subject to hierarchical manipulation. By looking at the work we do on ourselves in order to manage our emotions, she says that our understanding of emotion can confuse and can cloud our processes, because when this idea that when possessed we're in thrall, we're consumed, we're taken over, automatically implies that emotions are irrational. And yet, if you see a crying child in the street and you have an emotional response to go and comfort that child, that's surely not an irrational response. She also points out how emotions such as anger or jealousy are given an almost independent presence. We talk about that old jealousy, the idea that anger can be somehow stored in the body and erupt at certain points. And she uses a very sophisticated methodology to describe how, drawing on particularly on the work of the sociologist Irving Goffman, to describe how social functioning, cultural shaping takes place. In every social situation, we have feeling rules. We have ways of describing how things should happen. You're all being very polite here and looking interested. Nobody's asleep. Nobody's sort of shouting at me and saying, "What a lot of rubbish!" You might be feeling that. You might want to shout it, but you're all conforming to a certain social management of rules here. And that work that people do on themselves to conform to social demands inevitably has bodily implications. So if you're constantly in a situation where, and of course it's also hierarchically organized, in simple words, the less power you have, the less ability you have to express how you really feel in given social situations. And if you're constantly in a situation where maybe you step out of the door and you're subject to racial abuse every day, if you're constantly in a situation where you're having to work very hard to make your emotions conform to whatever social setting you're in, inevitably that's going to impinge bodily. So the kind of implications for health and illness are really enormous and quite dramatic. And the emotionally expressive body in health and illness very much informed can be very much informed and amplified by this approach. And I'm going to try and very briefly give you two examples of how this might work. The first is looking at pain, and in particular chronic pain. And this is a very famous diagram, I'm sure many of you will know it, from which is Descartes' idea of the automatic reflex. And his theory, of course, proposed that the intensity of pain is directly related to the amount of associated tissue injury. And this approach actually led to the development of the specificity theory, which was the dominant theory of pain until the mid-20th century, when it began to be accused of reductionism. And one of the people who was important in developing this kind of critique was the physician Beecher, who, his observations of World War II soldiers, he observed that only one out of five soldiers carried into combat hospital complained of enough pain to require morphine. Now, these soldiers were not in a state of shock, nor were they unable to feel pain. Indeed, when they complained when the IV lines were placed back, they complained of pain. When he was back home, he noticed that only one out of three civilian patients required morphine for pain from similar wounds. So Beecher put forward the proposition that the meaning attached to the injuries from the two groups explained the different levels of pain. To the soldier, the wound meant surviving the battlefield and returning home. The injured civilian often faced major surgery and a resulting loss of income, diminishment of activity, and many other negative consequences. So this focus on meaning in pain becomes explored scientifically through Melzack and Wall's gate control theory, which was put forward in the 1960s. And Melzack and Wall were, again, intrigued by what they called the puzzle of pain, particularly things like phantom limb pain, where patients who undergo the amputation of a limb may continue to report sensations or chronic pain that seem to come from that limb that's been amputated. This can, of course, include feeling that the limb's still there, or it may be a sensation of chronic pain. These sensations cannot actually come from the limb, of course, because it's been removed. So the specificity theory, in that sense, can't account for those findings, since there's no ongoing tissue injury in the amputated limb, which should mean that there would be no chronic pain. And again, I haven't got time to go into this in much depth, but they were also very interested in the phenomenon of placebo, a similar thing. Which people talk about the mind over body. And what their theory allows is this gate in the nociception, or the sensory components of pain, which is very much mediated by feelings and emotions. So back, bringing emotions back in again. And what we begin to see is the development of some social and cultural approaches to pain, which very much focus on this idea of meaning, and particularly the metaphorical nature of pain, even the definition of pain itself, coming from the Latin poena, as you can see, has a multitude of meanings, as well as the sensory implications, this idea of mental suffering, but also punishment or threat. And Dame Cicely Saunders, of course, who founded the hospice movement, gives us the notion of total pain. So this is really interesting. This is not just about mind and body. This is very far-reaching. It incorporates spiritual aspects, interpersonal aspects, and even financial aspects. And as David Morris says, pain is never the sole creation of our anatomy and physiology. It emerges only at the intersection of bodies, minds, and cultures. So as well as being a medicalized phenomenon, pain, of course, is a lay, everyday experience. It's not just a medical event. And my PhD work was an attempt to bring this sociocultural approach into the study of pain. I conducted an empirical, having been embedded in all these theoretical debates around emotional embodiment, I conducted a small empirical study in northwest London through a GP surgery, in which I first of all designed a very bad questionnaire, I have to say, trying to get at the nature of concepts of pain. and please don't worry about the figures, the point of this is that most of the responses that the 107, nice number, a very useful number, the 107 participants gave, most of the responses, as you'll see, are very much focused on physical pain and physical events. I think there's only 4% of people in the whole sample who talked about something emotional in terms of the pain when I asked them what their most painful experience was. But when I came to interview them in a subsample of people in their own home, a very, very different picture emerged. The interviews began with focusing on what was the most painful event. In the person in this quote, in his questionnaire, talked about the most painful thing being knee pain. But as I started talking to him, it's an incredibly complicated belief system about the pain he was experiencing, which related to his life circumstances, and particularly around the circumstances of his birth, emerged. This young man talked about, again in his questionnaire, his most painful experience was an abscess in his tooth. But again, when I interviewed him at home, he started describing to me a whole series of panic attacks he'd had, which he'd been seeking medical help for. He was very upset that he hadn't, that no physical symptoms had been found. But he was talking about the physicality of the pain he was experiencing from this. And again, this woman in the questionnaire had put down her most painful experience as she'd smashed her leg up in a motorbike accident. But when I started interviewing her at home, the whole picture changed, and she started talking about the separation from her partner, which she said resulted in the most physical pain she'd ever experienced in her life, where she was literally lying in bed at night, curled up in agony. So these are just some examples of this kind of blending of mind and body in terms of people's concepts of pain. There's also hierarchies of pain, whereas acute physical pain can even be seen as a kind of quite a positive thing in terms of a signal function. This chronic, more emotional pain was seen as incredibly negative. And again, a kind of intrinsic association of the gendered nature of pain. These kinds of notions around women being able to cope better with pain came out incredibly strongly. The idea that female bodies with hormonal and reproductive functioning seem to equip girls and women with some kind of natural capacity to cope with pain of all types, whereas no such biological preparation is available for boys and men. This woman here was describing about her grandmother using religion to help her cope with pain. And again, this notion expressed by this man who, as he says, all we do is shave, which is maybe not typical. So, but what comes through very strongly is that it's culturally much more acceptable for women to express and to seek help for pain, whereas for men, male socialization actively discourages them. And this kind of association of pain with nature and the natural comes through not just in terms of gender, but also the way that people talked about maybe other social groups as well. The second example I want to talk about is stress. And again, stress is one of those concepts that we use all the time. We talk about being stressed out, being burnt out. It's very much part of modern discourse. Stress-related illnesses, of course, are probably the biggest proportion of GP sick notes in terms of people being off work. But there isn't actually a medical condition of stress. If you go to the medical section of the bookshop, it's very difficult to find anything that's under the rubric of stress in that way. So How can these kinds of approaches help us to understand something like stress? Well, traditionally, of course, we have a very we all know that stress is linked to a kind of instinctive survival, the idea of the fight and flight, the idea that you're put in a particular situation where which triggers off all sorts of physiological processes in order to prepare you for fight and flight, a kind of mechanistic homeostatic model. And in this situation, of course, temporary stress is very useful as long as the body can return to normal, to homeostasis. But of course, if you're put in a position of being in chronic stress and your body is never allowed to return to normal, the idea is that that you develop ill health in the following sequence. So temporary stress is useful. Chronic stress leads to fatigue, leads to exhaustion, leads to lowered immunity, leads to ill health. And definitions of stress are very, and again, metaphors are very much around tension and pressure. And social models of stress, of course, have started to be developed, which involve biochemical, physiological, behavioural, psychological and social transactions between the individual and society. And what we can develop is actually in terms of maybe seeing stress as health capital. So on this side of the diagram, you have the demands of daily life, the actual demands every day, but also bigger events like life events. On the other side, you have resources, and this is very much in the kind of in the mode of Wilkinson and psychosocial determinants of health and illness. So what we can see is perhaps a paradigm shift in terms of models of health and illness. I'm sure you've all heard of the word biopsychosocial. Integrative is another word for that, which maybe encompasses the more social aspects in a more realistic way. One of the accusations of the biopsychosocial model is that the social is often talked about in a kind of utopian rhetorical way. And what this model does is actually incorporate emotion by including evidence-based medicine as well as values, including values-based medicine as well as evidence-based medicine. And we can see this kind of integrated model in all sorts of medical specialisms like pain clinics, oncology, and health psychology. And there's been some really interesting public health models which, again, are able to develop these integrated models to a much wider degree. And this, again, is an example of some work it did in terms of health promotion, in terms of understanding children's health beliefs and how they might relate to these more integrated models. If you ask children to write and draw about things that keep them healthy, just like adults, they know all about the fact it's diet and exercise. But if you ask them to draw things that keep them unhealthy, you get a much, much wider picture. We use this technique in older children, again trying to think about health and risk and ways that we might help inform health promotion campaigns. What you have here is a very worked out ideas from an 11-year-old girl about the health risks that she might take. In the first picture, the boy is smoking. She thinks that's very risky. She's never going to do it. The second picture, an adult is drinking. This is something she might do because it's not so risky. And of course, health is not always the priority. And unfortunately, pleasure, the risks that are involved that may be pleasurable may be illegal or even dangerous. So the BMJ and other journals are full of these kinds of questions are, do biomedical models of illness make for good healthcare systems? And the problem that of medically unexplained symptoms, i.e. illnesses or syndromes which are unable to be defined in terms of organic pathology, seen as abnormal and low in the illness hierarchy, permeate GP surgeries and referrals, sometimes referred to almost as heart sink patients. These are conditions that are unable to be resolved by biomedicine, in which patients experience very distressing physical symptoms, which range through pain, fatigue, mobility and coordination problems, fitting and vision problems. And there's an absence of clinical explanation or medical diagnosis, a kind of diagnostic limbo takes place here. And this again widens the gap between clinical reductions and lost metaphysics. The sufferers may remain incredibly marginalised. And as we see, I want to turn now to thinking about emotional health in this way. As we see, this is the ICD-10 and the DSM-4, which are the major ways of categorizing emotional and mental disorders. And the boundaries, of course, are expanding dramatically. For instance, the symptoms of depression include dysmia, i.e. emotion appropriate to circumstances, a very value-based judgment, and with potential for all sorts of accusations of social control in terms of deciding what's normal. Emotional disorders, of course, are increasing, as it says, across all income, all age groups, and all countries, particularly, again, in developing countries, where people have less access to treatment they need. Estimates vary, but they're very, very high in developed societies. And it's thought the Mental Health Foundation website talks about how 20% of UK adults have recognisable mental disorder. But what are we talking about here? And Joan Busfield, of course, has given us a very... We've always had the distinction between neurosis and psychosis, but Joan has given us a very useful distinction between disorders of thought and emotion and behaviour. And in contemporary Britain, the resourced mental health services are increasingly directed towards the chronic psychotic illnesses, whereas neurotic disorders are largely subsumed through the disorders of emotion rubric and treated with drugs like SSRIs and other mood-altering drugs. The more controversial behavioural conditions, such as substance misuse and personality disorders, are increasingly treated outside the NHS, if indeed they are treated at all. Treatments and therapies for many of these conditions, unless privately funded by the individuals, compete alongside other constrained resources, including the mental health services. So to even greater degree, the substance misuse services remain low priority, much as they always have been. And addictive or self-harming behaviour may be portrayed almost as a lifestyle choice. Thus, in terms of treatment, there are enormous socioeconomic differences, epitomised by the highly publicised celebratory rehab culture, which, of course, is in stark contrast to the grim reality of the addict living on the street. So, in terms of contemporary mental health care, we may have a shift from mental illness to emotional health. And this surely is an enlightened shift. It's destigmatizing, it's democratic, it's holistic. It can address mind-body conditions that traditional medicine cannot treat, and doesn't, and may enable us not to waste resources on treating things that medicine is unable to treat. But of course, despite the increase in life expectancy and the relative material well-being, it has been noticed by many critics this happiness gap. And the word affluenza, a kind of portmanteau word, much loved by the broadsheet media, designates how the middle-class virus brought on by social and material envy of a society obsessed by flash holidays, luxury goods, big salaries, expensive cars, individualism replaced by consumerism as the aspirational middle classes shackle themselves to unfulfilling jobs, work long hours and cut themselves off from proper relationships. That's a quote by Oliver James. So this idea of affluenza, sort of signifying a spoiled narcissistic society obsessed by material envy, body image, celebrity and reality TV. And the therapeutic critique, as it's often called, by critics like Frank Furedi, says that this happiness gap is there despite the increased life expectancy and relative well-being. And in this model, there's an avoidance of negative emotion. Negative emotion is seen as unhealthy or pathological. We mustn't feel dissatisfied, disillusioned, or miserable. The discourse of being stressed out, burnt out in midlife crisis focuses on our personal inadequacies, our guilt feelings, our conflicts, and our neuroses. And it encourages powerlessness and sick society and imposes a new conformity through emotion management. So in this model, social problems are interpreted as emotional, and the highly individualized idiom of therapeutic discourse is used to make sense of social isolation. So in conclusion, emotional health, is it a good and viable concept, an enlightened concept for the 21st century? If we accept the notion that all higher mammals seem to show signs of sadness under conditions of loss or helplessness, and that humans in turn have feelings that are shaped by language and where the suppression and the bottling up of traumatic experience leads to emotional problems, inevitably emotional distress will create health problems and may lead to medically defined illness. So in that sense, surely the concept of emotional health is enlightening and desirable. It seems axiomatic that the development of our emotional literacy will ultimately equip us with a more communicative, empathetic and open society, which has far-reaching collective as well as individualized implications. Health is such an important variable in social processes, and whether it relates to individuals or social groups, it can interact with other characteristics such as gender, race or class to exert a major influence on life chance and experience. Moreover, holistic concepts of health, which have been, of course, ever since the WHO in 1948 first defined health and well-being, enable radical change in what is meant by health, illness and disease, and means we can set our sights much higher than simply the avoidance of illness. But we do need critical analysis, read the potential of something, of the movement, potential of emotional health, for its potential to what's often called disease monger, to actually create new illnesses, new diseases, and to over-medicalise. So thinking about the leitmotif, which I hope I've been able to show has been pulled through this presentation, to turn to the future, and the concept of balance, which is intrinsically holistic and based on the Hippocratic view of the body as a microcosm of nature, is crucial to the process of intellectual and conceptual thinking, as it is to understanding and constructing models of healthcare. And the dissolution of the artificial divides between mental and physical health is an essential part of this rapprochement, as is the understanding of the social as well as the biological processing of emotions in the development of mind, body, society perspectives. Whilst biomedical research and scientific progress continues to be vital, it's equally important to advance understanding of the social and the socioeconomic factors, which of course play a part in the promotion and maintenance of health, the prevention and causation of disease, and in the relationship between these and the broader social structure, and to recognise the role of values-based medicine alongside evidence-based medicine. So an enormous challenge lies in this rapprochement, which in turn can encompass the political dimensions of the relationship between individuals and the wider social structure. We may not be able to find universally valid, comprehensive and agreed definitions of health and illness across all our disciplines and in the way we talk to each other, due to the great variability between cultures, historical periods, individuals, even the same individual over time. But instead of remaining embedded in debates which polarise either biological or cultural determinism, the way forward surely has to be through an integrated understanding. Thank you very much.